Welcome to the Radical Health Radio Show. Roots, runners, rhizomes, health and healing from the underground. I'm Sarah Faulkner.
And I'm Lauren Jambroni. This show is dedicated to exploring healing and wellness from a liberatory perspective, critiquing top-down systems and institutions, and instead looking up and around from below and alongside the way roots and rhizomes grow. Our show has not been evaluated by the FDA or any licensing body, and our intention is not to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease on air. By providing discussion, critique, and information from a variety of viewpoints, we hope you will feel more empowered, informed, and resourced as you explore your own options for self-care and working with different practitioners and providers.
Today, we're really pleased to have as a guest, Ro Giuliano, who is a nationally board certified and New York State licensed acupuncturist. She holds a Master of Science in Traditional Chinese Medicine from the American College of Traditional Chinese Medicine in San Francisco, California. She also holds a Bachelor of Arts in Human Development for Wellness and Holistic Health from Eckerd College in St. Petersburg, Florida. Ro has worked for over 10 years in the harm reduction community, and we're really pleased to have her on the schedule for today because actually that was a big request from our last show. A lot of people were like, what is harm reduction? We want to learn more about that. So we're really psyched she's here today. So she's the founder and former director of the San Francisco Needle Exchange, SFNE, which is a youth-focused needle exchange providing healthcare and harm reduction education to homeless and runaway youth of San Francisco. So hello, Ro. Welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Hi, Ro.
Very well.
Hi. Can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear us. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we're good.
Great.
Okay, well, welcome to the show. I'm excited to have you.
And thanks
for having me. Yeah. So, Ro, can you start us off by explaining to us what harm reduction is?
Yeah, I think for myself and generally in the community, a good way to think about what harm reduction is providing tools and education and empowering people in any way to make any positive behavior change. And it can be just that basic.
Mm.
I think there's some things that are, some tenets maybe that are important when you think about harm reduction. So it's empowering someone to be able to make any small positive behavior change, but also to remember that whether it's drug use or diet and lifestyle, that abstinence isn't necessarily the goal.
Mm-hmm.
You're basically working with someone exactly where they are, emotionally, and literally physically where they're at,
right,
to help them get to those goals. So if that means going physically to where that person is to provide a service that they need,
mm-hmm,
or if that just means kind of being where someone is emotionally and knowing that this is all they can do and just helping them, even if it's baby steps, to get to a place that's healthier for them.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so that's interesting because it kind of, I don't know what you think about this, Sarah, but it kind of butts against our kind of dominant culture or, you know, like Western idea of, you know, you go to a health provider because they're the expert and there's something wrong with your body and you don't know what it is or how to fix it, versus this philosophy where it's like the provider, the practitioner, or the counselor, or the person is more of a guide in the role. Does that make sense, Ro, or...?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I first started doing harm reduction work in the 90s, what we used to always say is it's drug users, their own expert on their drug use. You know, the counselor isn't the expert.
Right.
The drug user is the expert on their use. They know their habits. They know what they're doing. I think a way, too, to look at it, when I was doing a lot of work with young injection drug users, it was really important to see what they were doing to try to figure out where they were putting themselves at risk.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have all these people, researchers, everybody saying, oh, no, this is why they're getting hepatitis C. And not really seeing, example, how they were preparing their drugs. And in that, when you're asking people what they're doing, watching what they're doing, you can then maybe help them see where they were putting themselves at risk. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, totally.
So harm reduction kind of came Can you tell us a little bit of history? Did it come out of...
Harm reduction, like, as a, I guess if you want to call it as, like, a public health intervention or a philosophy, came out of Amsterdam, I think, in the late 80s, and came to the United States during the AIDS epidemic. And so you had people getting HIV, progressing to AIDS, and dying. This is totally way before HIV meds. And so there had... So the abstinence-based model that was so prevalent in this country was just not good public health anymore. It didn't... People weren't going to make it to even, say, quote-unquote, get clean.
Right.
Right.
And so as a public health modality, harm reduction was something that there was a lot of opposition against because it wasn't the prevalent model to work with drug users. But people were getting sick and dying, so there had to be something in between and realize that people may not stop using drugs, but you had to help people stop spreading this virus amongst each other.
Right.
You know,
and
maybe
so that's what really gave it the push in this country. Even if people weren't for it, it kind of helped force its way into the U.S. That way, through needle exchange and condom use. Like, those are two really basic examples of harm reduction.
It's interesting, too, because at that time, in this country, of course, Ronald Reagan was the president, and I just think of his kind of... you know, with Nancy Reagan's Just Say No policy and his own sort of earlier anti-communist, you know, better dead than red. And harm reduction seems like such a healing antithesis to that mindset because, you know, Just Say No is really about, well, it's better to be dead and not using.
Right.
And that's, harm reduction is so life-affirming.
Absolutely. And, you know, at the time, it was a very radical thing. Like, harm reduction programs in the beginning were very under the radar. I mean, you know, now it's a very accepted public health model, and there's all kinds of grants, but in the beginning, and I would say in the beginning, meaning from the late 80s, even until the late 90s, 2000, it was still something that it was, you know, kind of not the way this country likes to address public health or drug use. Or, you know, or safer sex, the way they want to look at it.
Were there people doing harm reduction model work, especially I seem to remember with needle exchange in the early days, people were prosecuted or harassed by legal authorities? Did that take place at all then? Or
It most certainly took place. When I started FFNE, we started FFNE like 97, 98, and it was in San Francisco in the Haight-Ashbury district. And at the time, Willie Brown was the mayor, and and the Haight-Ashbury district was going under some major gentrification. And the homeless and runaway youth, kind of street kids, used to hang out in the front of Golden Gate Park. And their answer to get them out of the front of Golden Gate Park was to build a fence around it and close the park. And also, at the time, there was one organization in the city that was allowed to do needle exchange. And so they didn't want to get involved in the politics of the neighborhood, so they actually pulled that needle exchange site. And they refused to do exchange with anyone under 18. Meanwhile, there was a huge population of under 18 injection drug users in that neighborhood that never left like a 3-block radius, let alone leave that neighborhood. So there was this huge gap in services, and at the time I was working in that community and I started FFNE, and when we started, I'd say about 4 weeks in, we got arrested.
Ooh, can you tell us more about that?
Were the charges? Totally. What was the story?
When we first started doing the exchange, it was totally underground, and it was just mixed in with regular outreach. So you'd be walking around the neighborhood, and you'd have, you know, granola bars, condoms, and needles. But there were so many kids, and the demand was so great, it needed to be more fixed. Like, it needed to be like, we're going to be on this corner from, you know, 4 to 7 o'clock, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And so that's how that happened. And once we did that, the cops just didn't like it. They wanted these kids out of that neighborhood. Those kids were not going to be leaving that neighborhood. And they arrested us. saying that we were basically violating, like, a business and professional code, that we were handing out, like, prescription, like, something that you needed a prescription for without a prescription.
Which were clean needles,
And that was, and at the time in California, you couldn't get, needles at a drugstore with a without a prescription.
Right.
Now you could, but then you couldn't. So that was the, that was their premise for arresting us. And that happened twice.
Wow.
How did that pan out when the, in, you know, that's what they charged you with, but did, were you prosecuted or how did that?
No, we had a really fantastic lawyer that did, you know, lots of free pro bono work for that kind of thing. And, I mean, at the time with the HIV rates and the hepatitis C rates, I also had worked at the time for UCSF Department of Medicine on hepatitis C studies, so there were a lot of people backing us, and we had had a fiscal sponsor already, so we were already, like, we're technically a nonprofit and had some backing behind us, and in a way, getting arrested at the time was the best thing for us.
Right.
It gave us a lot of publicity and a lot of attention to the neighborhood and to those kids and how they had just been pretty much left for dead. By a very big agency, San Francisco Foundation. And
put it out there.
Kind of after that second arrest, because the second arrest, they were like, oh, you're repeat offenders. So we were, like, held in jail overnight.
Oh.
Wow.
And so, you know, then it became an even bigger deal. And so it, it kind of helped with grant proposals. Like, people were coming to us.
Sure, sure. Mm-hmm. So,
you know, like the needle exchange in L.A. just, like, gave us 10,000 needles, things like that. Like, then it was, like, everyone was aware of what was going on in the neighborhood, and it really helped us get started.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it helped us get inside. Then the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic was like, we need to help them out and actually help facilitate us get a space inside, which was some of the complaints of the police at the time.
Wow.
That it was literally on the street.
And did you just start up SFNE with some friends, like, because you saw a need in the community that you could participate in?
Yes,
or how
did that?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you guys didn't...
A couple of us... Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, so I just want to back up a little. So I believe you didn't have your acupuncture training before you started either.
No.
So none of you were like, oh, I'm an expert or I'm a practitioner. You were all just kind of regular people that decided to start this up. Is that right?
It's outreach workers.
Okay. Right.
You know, like at the time, everyone that was involved at the time was either doing outreach work or was doing HIV risk assessment and disclosure counseling. In the field, like, for UCSF, so we would, it was, like, an outreach-based testing, you know, you know what I mean? So it wasn't, like, in an office, like, everyone was in the field in the Haight working with that population, and of that population, because it was, like, a very specific San Francisco kind of crusty punk scene, and everyone was musically even in that scene, so it very much felt like taking care of your own.
And so how, what are the links then between your work doing outreach and harm reduction work and then you becoming an acupuncturist? Are there? Is, I mean, did one follow the other? Or?
Yeah, a little bit. Once SFNE kind of got a little bit established and we got inside, we were very lucky and had healthcare providers working with us even when we were outside. We had a really fantastic physician assistant, and she worked at the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic. And she used to get tons of donations from that company, Herb Farm. And also there was this really great a co-op, Rainbow Grocery in San Francisco, that would donate herbs to us. And no one was an herbalist, really. Like, you know, like, I had my book, and I had to, like, read what things were good for. And there was an herbalist at the Santa Cruz Needle Exchange, which is a little bit south of San Francisco, and she had given us a great recipe for a vein care salve that the kids used to just call junkie cream, and we would make that. And once I started doing that, I just kind of got obsessed with herbs and started getting into it. That was kind of how I got into Chinese medicine that way. And the free the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic also had free acupuncture. And so, unfortunately, the majority of the kids that we worked with were positive for Hep C and had Hep C. And they were able to access free healthcare and free acupuncture at the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic. So it was really amazing to kind of be, to have access to that in that community, and that's kind of what turned me personally on to that.
That's great. That's really great. So so you went to school for acupuncture while you were still continuing your work?
Yeah, I worked, by the time I went to the Chinese Medicine Master's Program, I wasn't directing SFNE anymore because it was a full-time program. Like, I was just on the board of directors there. But all through school, I was still working with that population.
And what populations are you working with now? Are you in private practice, private clinical practice?
I'm in private practice, but I also do shifts at a community acupuncture clinic in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. And so, yeah. And when I first came to New York, I was working at Streetwork, which is a drop-in center for that same kind of population, homeless and runaway youth. And I did acupuncture there, too.
And so what do you think are some of the benefits of wellness work, like acupuncture and herbs, within the harm reduction, within like a harm reduction facility or drop-in center, like you said you were working at?
I think one thing that I always noticed, especially with young people, to talk directly about your drug use and getting people to want to quit is really scary, and they're not there yet. But for some reason, talking about taking care of your veins so that you can continue to get high was always something people were open to and not necessarily afraid of. And, you know, giving someone, you know, a salve to use on their veins or to teach them how to take care of their veins is that very act of starting to take care of themselves, touching their body, being aware of self-care. Right. It's like this little baby step. And I think things like that are so important, even though they're nowhere near ready to quit. And they may never quit, but it's just these tiny steps of self-care. Or when you, you know, just do acupuncture, just, even if it's just your acupuncture for a young person that's strung out and on the street, it gives them moments of quiet that are impossible to have when you're living on the street. And I think so much can come of that. And it's just these just very non-scary ways to begin self-care.
So how do you then, like, do you utilize it as, like, in your acupuncture practice now, or, like, what's another way that we can think about harm reduction being applied to just, like, everyday life?
For me, I guess it's just so ingrained in how, like, I do everything, I guess, because it just makes you acutely aware of, you have to, if you're working with another person, you have to work with them wherever kind of they are emotionally, spiritually, physically. I guess a good example would be if some, like, even if getting someone to take herbs, that's a patient, and, you know, they, it would be great if they could do raw herbs and go home and make a decoction, and that's going to be the best way they could do it, but they're not going to. Like, maybe all they're going to be able to do is, like, in Chinese medicine, you know, you have your raw herbs, but you have these herbal powders, and then you have, like, these patent pills. That's really not, for me, what I would want a patient to take, but that might be all they're going to be able to take. And that would be better than not taking anything at all in some situations. I guess that's the way I would approach it. Or if someone comes for acupuncture and they're really needle phobic, and you just kind of start slow, like, okay, I'm just going to put this one needle in, you know, things like that, just really taking things slow with people and making them feel comfortable and making them kind of feel in control and make some choices for themselves so they don't feel like you're telling them what's happening, that you're giving someone, you know, a couple of options and letting them choose where they feel comfortable on that continuum to begin that kind of journey of self-care.
Coming with a harm reduction philosophy already in place, how was it for you for your acupuncture training? Was there any kind of dissonance for you in what you were learning or how you were being taught when you were in school already having this philosophy, or was it just kind of pretty easy?
No, it was totally weird. It was, it was a little bit hard because, you know, some teachers thought, you know, it was San Francisco, and so in our school clinic, it was really affordable for people, and you would I guess this is a good example. You would get people that would come in that, you know, in San Francisco you have prescription, you have medical marijuana. So you would have a patient come in that's smoking for whatever health condition, and, you know, one instance I could think of where I had recommended to a patient to get a vaporizer,
mm-hmm.
that they weren't smoking, but they were still able to get their, you know, their herbal medicine, their mm-hmm. marijuana, in a way that was less harmful.
Mm-hmm.
And my teacher, like, flipped out on me after we walked out. You know, even
though
they have, you know, we have medical marijuana in San Francisco, they had a prescription, but, you know, to him it was like condoning this.
Uh-huh.
And that, like, I was very, I guess I was too drug positive for him.
Right.
Wow. But that's a really great example of harm reduction in another context, you know what I mean? Uh-huh. Like, okay.
Uh-huh.
You're having some lung issues, you still need to use medical marijuana, what about a vaporizer, what about, you know, eating it, things like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In your private practice also, I imagine some of your patients or clients, I'm not sure what word you use, they may see other practitioners. Do you ever have a conflict sort of with their overall treatment strategy? Like, you're coming from harm reduction background, but maybe they're seeing someone else who doesn't see eye to eye. Does that come up for you even now, or is that an issue?
I don't think so much now, mm-hmm. but it has come up before. But I think you kind of just find where you fit. You mm-hmm. know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so I usually tend to end up working with other people that are kind of coming from the same place I am.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But I think it's kind of a theory and practice that you could apply to anything. Like, a lot of times is always associated with drug use or sexual behavior. But, I mean, you can apply it to anything, especially anything like around, you know, nutrition, diet, mm-hmm. lifestyle, mm-hmm. things like that, where people are really attached to certain behaviors.
Mm-hmm. Have you found, do you have patients who are struggling with eating disorders? I'm a little curious about harm reduction and what are diagnosed as eating disorders, how that works for you. Just in my own life, I have a couple patients suffering from that, and it's very interesting to see how they have different practitioners with different philosophies about that. How do you have experience with that particular?
A little bit, not mm-hmm. a whole lot, but definitely. But it's in that same realm, because in a way you're saying, you're just recognizing that these behaviors are existing, and
mm-hmm.
also not projecting that they're, you don't want to project necessarily that it's problematic
mm-hmm.
in this negative way that's mm-hmm. going to then alienate this person from mm-hmm. getting any kind of help,
mm-hmm.
which I think is what happens a lot,
mm-hmm.
like.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're sitting there talking with someone, say, that's bulimic, and you're literally saying, like, okay, can you maybe only, like, puke after dinner
mm-hmm.
instead of
mm-hmm.
after lunch and dinner? Because that's,
mm-hmm.
but that's better, you know what I mean? And so some people...
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, other practitioners will have issue with that, because you are sitting there basically saying, this is, you know, instead of saying, this has to stop now, it's like you're recognizing this can't stop now. It's not realistic for that person at all.
Right, right.
And you're just going to introduce a bunch more, like, shame and stuff into that person's already complicated feelings.
Sure. Because so many of the things that we, you know, that we... you know, struggle with or deal with are so, you know, they butt up against dominant culture, like, oh, we have to look a certain way, or we have to act or think or do certain things in certain ways because everyone else is doing them, and that's
mm-hmm.
what makes you normal and accepted mm-hmm. and successful. And so I find that in my work in harm reduction, both with myself and other people I've worked with, that even just like around mental health stuff, like understanding that you might be a little bit different from the next person or struggling with what you need to do or have to do or should do, you know, you can just, like you said, Ro, use harm reduction in everything. Like, okay, the next time I beat myself up about X, Y, or Z, I'm going to recognize that I'm doing that and maybe stop, you know, or, like, maybe not do it that time. And it might come up later again. And you might be doing it, like, 20 million times a day. But, like you said, it's just kind of, like, non-judgmental, recognizing a behavior that's happening and, like, working slowly to reverse that or change that or shift that or transform that, right?
Absolutely. And in any small and positive way, even if that's like, maybe you can't stop doing that, but at least you're going to recognize it. And like saying that to yourself, okay, I'm just going to stop and be mindful that I did that. I'm not ready to, I can't do anything about it, changing it, but I'm at least going to maybe today just be mindful that I did it.
Right.
Whatever it is. You know what
right.
I mean?
Yeah.
So, Ro, we have to close up in a second, but I just, well, a couple minutes, I guess, but I just wanted to ask you, like, what are some of your favorite self-care practices that you're engaging in lately or have engaged in that you'd want to share with our listening folks?
I think for me, meditating and getting out in nature, and I think maybe that's because it's spring right now and it was such a very, very long winter, has been super important for me, right? Super important for me right now. But in the past, definitely just yoga and tai chi and things that get me quiet. I think living in Brooklyn, that's what's really calling to me the most that I need to care for myself is just getting quiet and just stopping.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's, you know, before I treat patients, I have to just stop and stay calm and quiet for, well, even if it's just 15 minutes before I start my day, just to get grounded and centered and be present.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you have a specific style or type of meditation practice or?
Sometimes I do some Qigong exercises, but a lot of times it's just grounding and centering and just trying to just be still and be in the moment and clear my head. Yeah.
Nice.
Or, you know, just different breathing, just be mindful of my breathing and just making that space and not making it something so technical. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Giving myself like, okay,
yeah,
it can just be this. I'm going to be quiet.
Awesome.
Sure.
Ro, I'm wondering, too, for our listeners who might want to learn more about harm reduction philosophy or get involved themselves where in the New York region, is there a website or a book or any kind of resource you could recommend for people to connect
with? The Harm Reduction Coalition, like harmreduction.org, they have a training institute that provides training. They also have, like, lots of materials. That's a good place to start in terms of links on their website.
Okay, great.
Harmreduction.org, I think that would be a really simple place to start.
Great. And listeners, we'll post that on our Facebook page, too, for our show, so that you can look that up. I think we're just about out of time now.
I just wanted just real quick, for folks who are listening out there who know a little bit about the harm reduction world out here in the Hudson Valley, I've been trying to look for places for needle exchanges and other harm reduction facilities that want to do wellness work or offer wellness work. I know that there's a place in Albany, but I'm just wondering if anyone out there knows of different programs or things in existence to contact me. And because I also worked with Ro down in the Lower East Side at the Homeless Youth Drop-In Center doing nutritional and wellness work as an herbalist with homeless youth, and I'd really like to continue that in some capacity. I just can't find anywhere around here that does that. So for all you folks out there, if you have any leads, you can email me at rootsrunnersrhizomes@gmail.com, and that'd be great.
And to everyone, as always, please email us there or post on our Facebook wall if you have any questions or suggestions for topics, interviewees, music, or any comments at all.
Yeah.
Our next show is going to be Monday, June 20th.
Oh, June 20th. June.
Yeah,
wow.
Right. Almost summer solstice. 3 p.m., Monday of the month, as always. And I think that's about all the time we have for today. Is that right? All right.
Yeah.
Thanks so much. Thanks, Ro.
Thank you guys so
much.
Listeners. I hope I was able to help you out with that topic.
Thank you so much. And we'll have the show archived up soon for everyone out there who wants to listen again or pass it along. And thank you so much, Ro. The work you do in the world is so amazing, and I'm really grateful for it. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Lauren, and thank you for everything you do.
All right.
Easy.
We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, you guys
take care.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, Acra, Catskill, Hudson, listener-supported hands-on radio for Green and Columbia.